Jeff Levering and wife Ashley love their new patio door from Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin.
It's like having a brand new kitchen.
I love the roll screen. The fact that the screen is on the inside.
Get 0% interest for up to 48 months. Visit PellaWI.com.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the Old National Bank talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank. Get old. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the Monday edition of the show. Rainy, cold. It's going to get better. I guarantee it. If you want to listen, if you want to watch us while we do this, we've been doing this for the last couple weeks. The cameras are going to be turned on in just a moment. You can watch us on our live stream. You can get it through YouTube. We've got a YouTube channel for WTMJ. Who knew? Or simply go to the WTMJ.com website, and there's that button that says Listen Live, and you can click that to listen. Or if you want to watch, you can click the button that says Watch Live and watch how the program goes on. I'm going to the Brewers game tonight, so I'm wearing my old school, you know, Brewers jersey and things like that. My Brewers top today, so looking forward to that. A lot of stuff to cover on today's program. Oh, by the way, I also want to mention that if you can't listen to the entire show, we make it easy. We have our podcasts that are also available anywhere you get your podcasts, and I see the numbers. Know a lot of people listen that way as well, so I very much appreciate it. Let's get started. I have had a degree of frustration that has been simmering all weekend. And it's really frustrating for me because I don't like to talk about problems unless I've got at least a solution to propose. Now, you might think it's a bad solution, but at least it's a solution that we can discuss. I'm kind of at my wit's end, though, when it comes to some of the out-of-control violence that's going on. If you had not watched the story, Friday night was, of course, Cinco de Mayo, the celebration of Mexican culture, right? And there was a huge gathering that formed on the South Side on Friday evening, like street celebrations and things like that. Some people described it, at least at the beginning, as, oh, this was a family celebration. Well, it might have been that way at the beginning, but by the end of the evening, the only family that was involved is if this was like the Adams family, okay? It wasn't the Osmond family by the time the evening had worn on. Here's the way the local newspaper describes it, and if you want to see some of the video, you can follow me at JeffWagner620. That's on Twitter. But the stuff is out there. Bob Donovan, who used to be the alderman that represented that area, now he's a state representative. You know, he captured a lot and sent this as well. So you've got this large gathering supposedly out there to celebrate Cinco de Mayo. And the crowd turned really, really, did I say really ugly? You've got a number of fights that are going on. You've got people with guns. Well, here's the way the local newspaper describes it. A video posted on Twitter and taken before shots are fired, there was two separate shooting incidents at least, shows a crowd gathered around three women who are fighting each other. As the fight grows more violent, multiple police officers enter the crowd to break up the altercation. Officers can be seen pulling the women from each other as objects are being thrown. Okay, so let me just back up here. You have this massive fight that breaks out. You have the police who are responding. They're trying to pull the women apart from each other. And if you watch this video, you have a huge crowd that is gathered. People are throwing things at the cops as they try to break up the fight. In addition, and this is something they don't mention in the local newspaper, what you will see is there are tens of people surrounding this scene. Nobody's helping break up the fight. Nobody's trying to assist the police officers who are having stuff thrown at them. Everybody's standing there with their cell phones out, just filming this brawl and filming all this. All right, so the story continues. Milwaukee Police Chief Jeffrey Norman said early Saturday morning that several officers were sent to the area due to a large crowd that was engaged in reckless behavior. Now, Bob Donovan, state representative and former alderman, says that they were taking cops from all over the city and rushing them into this area to try to get the crowd under control. Don't know how many police were pulled from other assignments around the city, but clearly that happened. The police chief said a short time later, several individuals started firing what he called celebratory gunshots. One of the videos posted on Facebook is filmed on a phone and shows a group of people running from the scene as shots are fired. A series of rapid shots are heard at the beginning of the video, but the source of those shots is never shown. As the video progresses, less rapid shots are heard before a video captures a police officer repeatedly shooting at a man who is lying on the ground 10 to 20 feet in front of him. In the video, a woman can be heard screaming, "Oh my God, they killed Dion!" as a group of people pleads with the officer to stop shooting. Interestingly, I don't think anybody was pleading with Dion to stop shooting before all this happened. Shortly after this, a handful of officers start to surround the man on the ground and ask the crowd to disperse. Norman said Saturday that one man suffered non-life-threatening injuries, while the other suffered serious injuries, but it stabilized by early Saturday. He said in both cases, officers gave the men several commands to drop their guns. And again, what apparently happened is there were two separate shootings that occurred with people who had pulled out guns and were shooting the guns up in the air. You watch this video, and again, you see these fights going on. The cops are trying to break up the fight. The crowd, nobody's helping. They've got their phones out. They're videoing it. People are throwing stuff at the police. If you follow me on Twitter, after watching this, I mean, my reaction was this. Why would anyone want to be a cop? Police try to break up a brawl while dozens of people stand by partying and recording the events with their phones. Every day, seriously, this community moves closer to becoming Escape from New York. You know, the movie where you just kind of like walled off the island of Manhattan and kind of let the criminals run, do whatever they want. My note says, actually, it might already be there. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank and Talk and text line. This is, in some respects, why we can't have nice things, I guess. You know, you have this celebratory party and things like that. And what happens is it quickly gets out of control. You have people with guns that show up. They start shooting off the guns. You have people that get into fights. You have a crowd that apparently is egging on the people who are in the fights. And at the very least, they're standing by and they're filming all this stuff while it's going on instead of assisting the police. And you know, people are looking at this, they're taking these films, and the idea is, okay, let's see if we can watch the police response, and let's see if we find officers that engage in excessive force while they're trying to separate people who are fighting, or let's try to film this, because then it's going to be, oh, this is police brutality, this is out of control policing, and all that sort of stuff. When the truth is, you know, this is a situation where you have these police officers that are called in, and it's gotten out of control because of the crowds, and more importantly, because too many people in the crowds have no impulse control at all. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. Now, I was going to start off the program today by saying, okay, what's the solution? Is it more arrests? Is it curfew enforcement to break up these crowds? But you know what? All that is like putting a Band-Aid on an underlying problem. And the underlying problem is you have people who have no sense of right and wrong. You have people who have no impulse control. And into this, we expect the police to come and provide order. And at some point in time, you got to wonder how often can we expect the police to do that? Our number is 855-616-1620. If you can't tell, I'm extremely frustrated by this, particularly people not helping the cops, people standing by, people with their cell phones out videoing this, people throwing stuff at the police officers. I mean, seriously, why would anyone want to be a cop and get assigned to have to deal with stuff like this? I'm sure the tendency is, okay, if this is the community that people want, all right, maybe we should just give them the community we want. Let this get out of control. Let people get beat up. Let these fights happen, and then see how long it is before maybe the good people who live in this community say enough is enough. But it's the start of the summer season. It's only early May. And given what I saw on these videos on Friday night, I don't have a lot of hope for the rest of the summer. 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. I don't mean to start Monday out with this level of frustration, but if you weren't watching Friday night, Southside, big Cinco de Mayo party, and it's fine up until, I don't know, about 9 o'clock at night, maybe 9:30, when the tone and texture completely changes. You've got a whole bunch of people engaging in reckless behavior. There's people with guns that are firing the guns off. There's these fights in the crowd. The police are called to respond. There's a video of at least three cops trying to break up this fight between three women who are just wailing at each other. People start throwing stuff at the police who are there. Everybody else is standing by the side. You just see this one person after another. Woman's climbing up on a car with a cell phone trying to video as the police are trying to struggle to get these women to stop beating you-know-what out of each other. There's people with guns. Two people are shot, one 17-year-old and one guy in his 30s, who are in the crowd firing, refusing instructions to drop their guns. So there's two separate police shootings. But it's this over, out-of-control mayhem. You've got cops who are apparently, according to the state representative Bob Donovan, being called in from all over the city because this is an out-of-control mob. And it's only May 5th. And I don't have a good answer. But I'm telling you, if we don't get a handle on this, or more importantly, if people don't learn how to behave in large groups, it's going to be one heck of a long summer. Let's start with Rebecca in Burlington. Rebecca, you're on WTMJ.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, my question is, actually, it's not so much my question. My comment is an answer to your question about why the people aren't stepping in to help the police officers or to help protect others. Look at what happened in the subway in New York last week.
Yeah.
That Marine who stepped in to help the passengers looks like he's being charged with murder.
Yeah, the guy who put the right, you had the out of control homeless guy and you had the ex-Marine who put him in a chokehold, right? Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And the guy who was causing the problem should not have been out on the streets for a variety of infractions.
Right.
And yet, there he is, repeatedly intimidating, threatening, harming people. And when somebody finally stops him, the guy who stops him is in trouble.
Thanks for the call, Rebecca. It is a weird thing. Now, I don't know. I got to tell you something, though. As I'm watching this video, I don't think the vast number of people who were throwing stuff at the police on Friday night or videoing it, I don't think their concern was, gee, I want to help try to break up this fight. I'm afraid that I might end up get charged with something. It was more like, oh, this is just, it's street theater that's going on here. Or, I want to film this. I want to be able to put this up on Twitter or put this on Facebook or whatever. And if I catch an example of a police officer engaging in, you know, in what some people might say is overly, they're doing too much violence or whatever, then I'm going to be famous because I'm going to be the one that has this. Meanwhile, you've got a handful of cops that are outnumbered by an out of control mob. And I seriously wonder at some point in time, how do we stop this? And how do you find cops who are willing to rush into this? How long is it going to be before you have police officers who say, okay, we've got another one of these street events that is completely out of control. There's all these brawls. And the cops just sit and say, well, all right, why don't we just let this go? Because if we get into the middle of it, you know, people are going to throw stuff at us. Where did this become the new normal, for goodness sakes? Marty in Oak Creek. Marty, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Just last night, my wife said, oh, James Taylor's coming to town, and I said, Summerfest, because we're not going. That's just how we feel about the summer. I don't trust Milwaukee. I don't want to go. But at the same time, I would give license to the police to just do mass arrests.
Mm-hmm.
If you can pull out a phone and tape it, you're not helping anything. You're in the way. Arrest them. And then start searching. Are they here illegally? All the different things. I'll bet you there's a lot of illegal guns there.
Well, I'll bet you there are a lot of illegal guns because there were all sorts of people that were shooting off the guns. I guess that's the question. And that's something the community is going to have to decide. And I don't know what the answer is but we get the community that we ask for. So imagine this. And again, okay, this is Cinco de Mayo, but next Friday there's some other massive street event or whatever that starts to get out of control. So here is the question that people have to answer. Do you want to see a massive show of force by the police where you pull up, you announce, okay, we got a curfew here, you know, it's time, you've got to disperse, etc., and you tell people to go home? And if people don't go home, do you want the police to start making arrests? Is that what's going to happen? Do you want police to start being aggressive and pulling people over who are carrying guns and things like that when the fights break out? Do you want police to show up en masse, start making arrests of the people who are involved in the fights, and start filming stuff themselves? So if you've got a bunch of people who are throwing stuff at the cops while they're trying to do their job, do you want them arrested? Now, I mean, that's the decision we have to make, because it seems to me it's one way or the other. Either you want to have civil order and you want to have the people who are misbehaving arrested and then prosecuted, John Chisholm, or alternatively, why send the police into a situation like this? If we're not going to enforce the laws, if we're just going to let these crowds get out of control, we're going to let people shoot off the guns, then maybe the other question is that what the community wants? Is that what is acceptable? Just let everybody then go. And if there's property that's destroyed, well, that's too bad. If there's people that are shot, that's too bad. But is that what the community is asking for? And again, I'm not just talking about the people that were there on Friday night. I'm talking about people all across the community, because this happens way, way, way too often. Large crowds gather at the lakefront. Large crowds gather here. Large crowds gather there. We're going to have to figure out over the course of the next couple weeks and months how we're going to deal with this garbage. That's the truth. And we're going to have to decide, are we going to be aggressive in going out and prosecuting the bad actors, whoever they might be? Or are we going to just simply say, this is the community that people want, and so let's just turn a blind eye to it and just try to sort it out after it's over? And I'm sure there is an incredibly high frustration level on the part of the police chief. I mean, can you imagine? It's Friday night, and you've got, again, it's something that it turned ugly at a certain point in time. And I don't know whether that's 10 o'clock or 10:30 or 11 o'clock, but you had a lot of families that were participating in a celebration. The families go home and the troublemakers stay. And that's what you saw. So I guess that's what we need to hear from the community. And by the way, I listened to some of the stuff on the news and some people saying, well, we just need more activities. And oh, okay, give me a break. All right. You know, if you're out at 11 o'clock at night with a gun in the middle of a crowd firing off that gun, the answer isn't universal driver's ed. The answer isn't, you know, after school basketball. The answer is, you know, you need to either leave that gun at home, go find something productive to do, or you need to have consequences. And my question is sincerely, you know, are we as a community willing to say we want to have consequences for the people who are the bad actors? Or moving forward, if we're not going to do that, why put the police in the middle of this stuff? And now you're going to get a lot of attention. Well, the police had to shoot two people who refused to drop the guns that they had that were in the middle of the crowd. Well, okay, some people are going to see the police as bad guys, and inevitably there's going to be people out there looking to hire lawyers to sue the cops. Then the question is, okay, what are you doing firing off a gun in the middle of these crowds in the first place? And what are these out-of-control crowds doing as well? So very glad to have you with us. I'm sorry, it's just aggravating. Jeff, I just sold my last two rental properties in Milwaukee. No longer felt safe. Over the years, spoke with many police that worked in the area. They're hesitant to get involved. They arrest someone just to see them out on the streets the next day. So what's the point to arrest anyone? Also, the police have families they want to go home to. They don't want to get shot at by somebody that's out on the streets that should not be. Incarcerate the criminals. Get them off the streets. That is the solution. Yeah, it's the solution, but it's a politically incorrect solution. And so I'm afraid, have to put up with more of this stuff as the summer goes on. People on our text line are poking the bear. One of the notes says, Jeff, how about the Office of Violence Prevention? Yeah, this is the Milwaukee Office of Violence Prevention that in 2021 got over $12 million, I believe, in taxpayer money. Its regular budget, when you don't have the COVID money, is like $5.6 million. Yeah, how's that Office of Violence Prevention doing to stopping things like have been happening on a regular basis, including the travesty that went on last Friday night? $5.6 million. Well, we're sending people to conferences. Yeah, good luck with that. When we come back, a tale of two schools. Who's got it right and who's got it wrong? I'll explain. We'll discuss. You know, the world really has gone crazy. So there is this ongoing debate now about, you know, shared revenue and the Republicans, after years of kind of resisting changing the shared revenue formula, particularly when it comes to Milwaukee, in part because of the irresponsible ways that Milwaukee has spent money over the years. Finally, there is a breakthrough. And Republicans, after working with the mayor and the county executive and people from all over the state, announced this plan that, okay, we are going to change the formula. We're going to send a bunch of money back to Milwaukee. This money, and it goes to other communities as well, but it's really as much as anything for the benefit of Milwaukee. It will allow Milwaukee to bail itself out of its pension problem, and it will allow Milwaukee to generate revenue for other sorts of things. Now, you know, one of the conditions is, all right, if voters are going to impose an additional sales tax, you got to vote for it. There has to be a binding referendum. And after years of all these elected officials saying, give us the opportunity to vote for this, give us a binding referendum, now they're afraid that they might not be able to sell the binding referendum. So now it's like, we don't want this. We don't want a binding referendum. Okay, well, be careful what you wish for. But there are some strings that are attached to this. And I don't think any of these quote-unquote strings are unreasonable. In particular, as a condition of getting all this money sent back from state sales taxes to Milwaukee, one of the conditions is you can't hold the police department hostage. You have to agree that as a condition of getting all this money, you're going to have a floor of like 1,600 and some police officers, with the idea that it's going to increase to 1,700 or some, which is still nowhere near as many as cops as you need. But you have some of the people out there saying, well, this is just terrible. We want local control. Well, I'm all in favor of local control, except when some of the people in localities demonstrate that they are irresponsible and can't be trusted with it. So this is one of the things. How dare the state tell us that we have to hire cops? One of the other conditions, and this is one of my favorite ones, is that, all right, as a condition of getting this money back, you have to agree that there's going to be 25 police officers that are going to be put in schools. Now, if people who've been keeping track at home, it started in 2016 and then took up speed in 2020. You had a number of very, very liberal, politically correct members of the Milwaukee School Board, fueled by some elected politicians, some liberal elected politicians, and some students who didn't like the idea that there would be police in the schools. Now, most communities around here have police in the schools. And so they pulled it out. The idea is, well, we don't want the kids to feel like this is a pathway to prison, you know, if they see police officers in the school, which is just an incredibly ridiculous and irresponsible position to take. On top of it, as I've been arguing for quite a while now, just because you don't have school resource officers there on a regular basis doesn't mean the cops aren't in the schools, because if you look at the numbers, cops are getting called to MPS schools every day, sometimes several times a week, to deal with the criminal behavior, the violence, etc. So the rule, as a condition of getting this money back, would say you have to have 25 police officers in the different schools, and they decide which schools got the cops based on the number of police that have to report to the schools anyways. So over the weekend and starting on Friday, there's a united front. Well, here's the way the Journal Sentinel describes it. A united front of Milwaukee school board members and community organizations, and these are very, very left-wing community organizations, on Friday denounced the plan from state lawmakers to force MPS to have at least 25 Milwaukee police officers in the school, while the mayor and superintendent have been quiet on the issue. Marva Herndon, newly selected MPS school board president, said Friday the bill would destroy Milwaukee's right to self-govern. She was joined by other board members and community organizations calling for the police school provision to be removed. It clearly has racist overtones. Don't you get tired of playing the race card, of people playing the race card? As Milwaukee has the largest minority population in the state, we will not stand to be forced on this. Okay, it has nothing to do with the race of students. It has to do with the violence in the schools that require police response on a regular basis. But it's easier to play the race card than to deal with this. So anyhow, the position of MPS and some left-wing school organizations is we don't want the police, we don't want officers stationed in the schools where they might be in a position to respond quickly if there's a school shooting, intervene early on if there's a fight. No, we'd rather have the criminal activity, you know, go on and then have to make the police call and see what happens. So that's the attitude, because not having police in schools hasn't eliminated any crime at all. But that's the position MPS takes. Now, here's a different school, and here's what they're doing. University School of Milwaukee. University School of Milwaukee is based in River Hills. It's probably the elite private school in the region. Some people might argue with that, but it is a very, very good school. It is very expensive to attend, although they do have scholarship programs and things like that. But University School of Milwaukee is very, very highly regarded. Here's what they've announced. Security staff, according to the local newspaper, started carrying firearms May 1st as a regular part of their jobs at University School of Milwaukee. All right, the communications director for the school said there are 3 to 5 members of the school's in-house security team who carry guns. All of them are former police department officers who have already been working at the school as unarmed security staff for many years. They said the decision was made by the head of the school after conferring over the past year with members of the school's board of trustees, legal and insurance consultants, security experts, and the local police. In a letter to families, the headmaster said the move was in response to the devastating rise in school shootings nationwide. Through extensive analysis and thorough research, along with strong recommendations from the River Hills Police Department, the unanimous recommendation of our board of directors was to arm a small number of school safety officers. Since the letter was sent out, the headmaster said most of the response has been positive. The staff carrying guns have concealed carry permits, and the guns will be worn underneath their jackets. They've received training, et cetera, et cetera. So University School is saying, okay, we don't have the police here, but what we've got is we have trained security people. We want them to be armed. We want them to be there as a deterrent, and we felt we need to do this in response to the rise of school shootings. The contrast is MPS, where there are calls to schools on a daily basis to deal with problems, criminal behavior, etc. The official MPS response is, how dare you expect us to have police officers, armed or otherwise, in the schools? Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. Okay, who's right? If you had a kid in school, would you feel better with the approach that University School has taken, which is we're going to have armed, trained security people, retired police officers? They are going to be on the school premises in an effort to deter school shootings, etc. Or the MPS response, which is police? We don't need no stinking police in our schools. 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. If you're just tuning in, University School of Milwaukee, which is located in River Hills, it's one of the, if not the elite private schools in the state, for sure, maybe in the country. You know, they've just announced a new policy where they have some school security officials who are retired police officers who will be carrying guns on the campus. At least 3 to 5, I think, is what they said. They received training, etc. In contrast, over the weekend, Milwaukee Public Schools having an absolute hissy fit. The board is upset. You've got certain left-wing community groups who are upset that as part of the revenue sharing proposal, they would be required to bring school resource officers back into the schools where they have the greatest problems so far. And, oh, how dare you? How dare you require us to bring police back into these schools? It's really an interesting contrast. Here's one of our texts. Jeff, as a school resource officer for 15 years, now retired, there is absolutely nothing bad at all about having police officers in the school. Obviously, Milwaukee does not need the money as bad as they think. My reaction is to heck with, actually he uses a different phrase. My reaction is to heck with Milwaukee as a whole regarding revenue sharing if they refuse to deal with this. Jack in Milwaukee. Jack, you're on WTMJ.
Hi, I just wanted to say, I also was a resource officer for 25 years. I am now retired. We were the school that had the trial program for when the police officers were first united with MPS. And it worked great. And the main thing was, it isn't that it kept the problems down, but we had immediate police response.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what they want to do is, when they remove them out of there, what they wanted to do, because there are so many problems at MPS, they don't want everybody to know every single problem. Okay, by having the police in there, okay, you have no choice. You have to give it to the public.
Right.
But by keeping them with the safety officers in there, you can keep it within the school.
Oh, so the public. Your point is, so the public doesn't really know how bad it is if you don't have the police there, because if the police see the fight or whatever and they issue the citations, then that citation becomes part of the public record.
Let me ask you this. When you drive a public school, if you drive by a public school and you see a police car out there, do you know why that police car is out there?
I do not. I mean, I assume that there's.
Okay, there you go.
Okay. Interesting. Let me ask you.
This has been going on for a year.
Okay. Interesting. Let me ask you the other thing, Jack. Besides the immediate response, I've always thought that having a police officer in the school helps humanize, you know, police. You have kids that can interact with a police officer and get to know Officer Jack or whatever, and, you know, maybe see police in some different capacity than just when they're getting pulled over for speeding or something like that.
Well, now, I cannot tell you, okay, how many of the kids have come up to me as a safety officer and told me about serious situations such as weapons that are within the school.
Mm-hmm.
And they absolutely refuse to talk to the police. The police are not their friend. They see them coming in. They pick up their parents. They pick up their mothers. They pick up their brothers and sisters. And to them, the police are enemies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. This is a way to humanize the police officers, because you get to say, okay, well, I know that particular police officer, but look, I also get it. You've got that immediate response. Interesting theory that, you know, one of the ways you keep people from knowing how bad the problems are is if you can kind of keep them all in-house. It's like some of the shopping centers around here who, over the years, would discourage retailers from reporting shoplifting, because if you call the cops for shoplifting, there's a police report that's filed, and that police report becomes public and people can understand how bad it is. And then they can say, okay, well, maybe I don't want to go to shop at X shopping center because there's all this thievery going on. Meanwhile, if you just tell the merchants, look, we don't want the word to get out that shoplifting is as bad as it is here. We're going to like not tell anybody about it, as if that's going to make the problem go away. Jeff in Milwaukee. Jeff, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Good.
You just stole some of my thunder. My original comment was, university school has got it going on, and I find it completely ironic that a school that, and I'm assuming, probably has the least amount of problems of having police needed to be called at to that school, they're the ones that are smart and taking the initial
mm-hmm. right.
the initiative on it. I don't know why MPS is so scared of police officers, and where you stole my thunder is, It does develop a relationship with that school liaison police officer. I know it from my daughter from being in Brown Deer, you know, 5 years ago, and they loved that officer, and it was a big help.
Yeah. No, I mean, thanks for that. That is the, you know, that's the real question, and I'd like to have. See, like a lot of the local reporters, particularly the local newspaper, if you thought it was left-wing before, it's taken a really, over the last several months, a really hard turn to the left. You'd like to have somebody really stand up and say, I've got a serious question. What is your beef? What is the real problem with having police officers in the school? Let's forget about this kind of local control thing, because the real question is, why don't you want cops in the school in the first place? What is the downside to having a police presence on a regular basis in these schools where the cops are getting called on a regular basis anyways? What is the downside of having somebody that's there for, you know, who can respond? And that's it. Then it's like, humana. We don't want it to be an armed camp. Okay, that's silly. This is a lot of this left-wing, anti-cop, defund the police nonsense that puts public safety at risk. Cindy in Muskego. Cindy, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hi. I just want to say that my kids grew up in West Dallas, went to West Dallas schools in the 70s and 80s. And they had officer friendly in schools practically all the time. And the kids would just loved officer friendly. They would teach them, you know, safety things. And kids got to feel that officers are there to help them, not to, you know, not to be angry against them or to kill them or hurt them or anything like that.
No, Cindy, you're exactly.
There's nothing wrong with that. Kids love the officer friendly.
Well, exactly. And that's it. And plus, that officer is there in the case that there is that out-of-control fight that breaks out, and then everybody pulls out their cell phones, and they're calling their family and stuff, and come here. You've at least got an officer who's on the scene who can respond immediately while you're waiting the 5 minutes or the 10 minutes or whatever it takes to get the other officers there to break this up. And if we were having a conversation about, well, okay, it's either police in the schools or no police in the schools, it might be a different thing. But to all the people on the MPS board, look at the numbers. There's already cops that are in the school on a regular basis because crime and misbehavior continues to be out of control. And nobody's come up with a good reason to not have the police in the school. This local control stuff is just a complete and total red herring. And it demonstrates that if you've got a board of directors, for example, whose judgment is so bad that they don't want police in the schools, well, maybe that's a good reason why local control isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the program. Have you ever heard the phrase cognitive dissonance? Cognitive dissonance is a phrase that actually from psychology, and it's the state of having inconsistent thoughts or attitudes. So thoughts that just don't go together. Here's a real world example of this. And Connie was talking a little bit about it. Last night in Fond du Lac, there was a shooting that occurred at a place called Maplewood Commons. Fond du Lac police responded within minutes of the shooting. It happened around 7 p.m. There were three shooting victims, two women ages 20 and 18, and a man, age 49. All were taken to hospitals. The 20-year-old woman later died. Okay, so you have three people that are shot. 20-year-old is dead. The police, and I'm just looking at the story, they've now identified the shooters. They say the shooters ran away are at large with multiple agencies looking for them. The Fond du Lac Police Department has entered temporary felony warrants for two persons of interest involved in the shooting. And they've got their pictures up. I'm looking at the story on Fox 6. Antonio K. Johnston, 17 years old, and Paris E. Larry Jr., 14. So the Fond du Lac police think that the people responsible for this murder and the shooting, it's a 17-year-old and a 14-year-old. As I'm looking at the thing that the police put out, do not attempt to apprehend these subjects. All right. So they're like, if you see these people, call the police. Do not attempt to apprehend these suspects. Okay. I understand all that. The suspects are considered armed and dangerous. Do not attempt to apprehend these subjects. They are considered to be armed and dangerous. Okay, we get the idea. By the way, you get the ages? A 17-year-old and a 14-year-old are wanted for the murder and the two shootings. Armed and dangerous. Do not attempt to apprehend these subjects. Okay, that's all well and good. But then I continue with what the police are saying. While the suspects are considered armed and dangerous, officials say there isn't a threat to the area. Wait, this is cognitive dissonance. You've got these two teenagers who they believe murdered somebody, shot two others. They are armed and dangerous. They are on the loose. Do not attempt to apprehend these subjects. But you're saying there isn't a threat to the area. What the heck? I mean, seriously. They then also go on to say they encourage neighbors to lock all doors and windows. So you've got these two kids, teenagers, who are believed to have murdered somebody, shot two other people. They're armed. They're dangerous. Do not attempt to apprehend these subjects. Neighbors, lock all your doors and windows. But there isn't a threat to the area. I mean, okay, that is an example of what we call cognitive dissonance, two ideas that are just internally inconsistent. Now, I understand the Fond du Lac police don't want to panic people, but here's the bottom line. There's two 17 and a 14-year-old who have shot three people. One is dead. They are armed and dangerous. They are on the lam. So, yeah, it seems to me by definition there is a threat to the area. But, you know, that's just me. That's just me. A follow-up on something we talked about last week. A week ago today, there was that example of reckless driving. You will remember outside of Morse Middle School on North 80th Street, essentially between Mill Road and Good Hope Road, there was the situation, five kids in a stolen Kia, 9 o'clock in the morning, driving at a high rate of speed, weaving down the street, and this was captured on video, which really kind of hits home, smashes into the rear of a school bus at a high rate of speed. One of the kids in the stolen car, a 15-year-old, and they're all hanging out the window. The 15-year-old is thrown from the car, and when last I heard, he was still in critical condition with life-threatening injuries in the hospital. The other four people in the car get out and run away. And that was captured on, again, surveillance video as well. They're fleeing. I believe on Thursday, two people, a 15-year-old girl and a 14-year-old girl, were arrested on Thursday. These were two of the four that were running away from the car. They were passengers in the car. On Friday, the suspected driver was taken into custody along with a separate 14-year-old girl. So you've got the 15-year-old who's hanging out of the car. You've got a 14-year-old, 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, driving a stolen car, who drives it into the rear of the school bus and then flees. You've got another 14-year-old girl, a 15-year-old girl, and a different 14-year-old girl. And I believe, now that I mentioned, I think there might have been six people total in the car. There's still one more that's at loose. But the driver was a 14-year-old boy driving this stolen car. And now you have all the carnage that this has occurred. Yeah, there's one more suspect that they're looking at, and there haven't been charges filed as of yet. Now, one of the sad things is if they decide to kick this case to juvenile court, you're never going to necessarily know if there have been charges filed. I will tell you this. Under these circumstances, it will be an absolute travesty if there is not an attempt to waive these people into adult court, starting with the 14-year-old driver of the stolen car. If you can drive a stolen car in this fashion, and you got to presume that these kids were involved, at least some of them were involved in stealing the car. I don't think that that's an unfair presumption. How did they get in the car otherwise? 14 years old, joyriding, slams into the rear of the car. One of his 15-year-old buddies is thrown from the car, may or may not live. Then everybody flees. If you don't waive this 14-year-old into adult court, it will be a travesty. If I'm the DA, I'm looking at everything I can possibly do to consider waiving the other people who are passengers in this car, parties to a crime, waiving them into court as well and treating them as adults. If you don't do this and you simply slap them on the wrist and send them back to mom and dad, with instructions, well, try to watch them and make sure they don't steal another car and drive in this fashion again, you know it's going to happen. Now, we haven't heard what the decision's going to be, but if they don't try to waive this 14-year-old into adult court, like I say, it will be an absolute miscarriage of justice. Will the DA's office have the guts to do it? Who knows? But the community needs to stand up and say enough is enough. And if you got 14-year-olds that are going to steal cars and 14 and 15-year-olds that are going to drive recklessly, it really is a situation where if you're old enough to do the crime, I think you need to be old enough to do the crime. When we come back, let's talk about what happened in the northwest part of the state the other day. Stick around. In early February, a man shot and killed Milwaukee police officer Peter Gerving after a robbery. Then April 8th, which was about a month ago, you might remember the situation. There was a shooting of two police officers in Barron County in the northwest part of the state. On April 8th, Officer Emily Breitenbach of the Chetek Police Department and Officer Hunter Scheel, who's 23 years old, of the Cameron Police Department, pulled over a vehicle driven by a guy from New Auburn after they received a report of concerning behavior. He killed them. You will remember that story. So at the time, that made three law enforcement officers who were killed in the line of duty. It has happened again. Exactly 1 month after the murders of the two police officers, we now have another murder. This is in neighboring, by that I mean neighboring to Barron County, St. Croix County. Saturday night, May 6th, what happened is around 6 p.m., a deputy, it's just a horrible story. A deputy finds a suspected drunk driver in a ditch. The driver was identified as a guy named Jeremiah Johnson. Apparently, people had stopped by the scene to try to help. Katie Lysing, 29-year-old deputy from St. Croix County. She was a sheriff's deputy who had been with St. Croix since 2022. Before that, she'd worked in a sheriff's office in South Dakota. So there's people that are gathered. There's the car in the ditch. They think the guy is drunk. She shows up. And she asks the guy who's in the ditch to perform field sobriety testing. According to reports, he was evasive to her requests. So after about 8 minutes of talking back and forth, apparently he pulls out a handgun and shoots her. She fired at him three times after she was shot, but none of the shots hit him. He then flees into a wooded area. Those who had gathered together to try to help the guy who was in the ditch in the first place try to save Deputy Lysing's life. She ultimately died from her injuries at the hospital. The guy who shot her flees into the woods and subsequently, shoots himself, kills himself. They find the gun next to his body. But here you have the fourth law enforcement officer in essentially, we're early May, so we're 4+ months into the year. Four Wisconsin law enforcement officers have lost their lives. And for people who think that, well, the danger that you have is exclusively in urban areas. And believe me, there's a lot of danger that comes with being a police officer in an urban area. You work for the Milwaukee Police Department, and the Lord knows, what kind of call you're going to get to respond to, what kind of shooting thing that's out there. But three of the four deaths of police officers this year have been in rural areas, and they've been in connection with what we would typically consider to be the phrase, quote unquote, air quotes, if you're watching me on our live stream, routine traffic stops, which has always demonstrated to me why there really is no such thing as a routine traffic stop, because when you show up, in this case, you've got a car that's in the ditch and you think the guy might be drunk, you don't anticipate that the drunk driver is going to pull out a gun and shoot you. When you go to pull somebody over because there's an out of the tag on the license plate's expired, or there's no tag, or there's no rear lights or whatever, you don't expect that this is going to turn into a shooting instance. But sometimes it does. So you have this this police officer who, 32-year-old police officer who ends up, dead. In just, again, one of these senseless things, there's all sorts of witnesses there. You just show up. There's a car in the ditch. You think that the guy might be drunk. And after a handful of minutes, he pulls out a gun and he shoots her and then ends up killing himself. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. between the disrespect that is shown to officers on a regular basis. You know, we talked about that in the first part of this program where the police officers try to break up a fight and break up this out-of-control mob at the Cinco de Mayo thing in Milwaukee on Friday, and the response of people is to stand by and watch the police officers get stuff thrown at them or to throw stuff at police officers. Between the lack of respect that's shown, between the impulse control of fruit flies that so many have on the street, and the general let's defund the police movement, the people out there who believe the cops are an occupying force, let's get them out of the schools, let's get them out of our neighborhoods, we don't need more police. Between all that and the ever-present and the willingness of people to use more and more violence against police officers, four shootings already this year. 855-616-1620. Can you imagine why anybody would want to be a police officer? And if you have kids who are thinking about going into law enforcement, does this make you think twice about their choices? If you have family members who are in law enforcement, does this make you think twice about their choices? You know, I said this rhetorically a little while ago, and I got kind of a snarky text. Well, They're very highly paid. You can make, you can make $75,000 to start, and you get these great insurance benefits and all. Why wouldn't anybody take it? Well, you wouldn't take it because, all right, for most of us, we have good days and bad days, but our bad days don't involve some clown shooting us. 855-616-1620. Should this type of stuff make people rethink careers in law enforcement? And where is the next generation of cops going to come from? We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620. Here's a tech chip. We just lowered the flag at our police department for that deputy. Very, very sad. Sooner rather than later, I fear the people in society are going to figure out what it's like to not have any law enforcement and or any law and order. Quality of life in the suburbs and in the cities, as we are seeing already, is going to be very, very bad. Jeff, I have friends as well as a godson nephew that's in law enforcement. Of course it concerns me. Why would you want to do this? I'm very thankful that we have officers that do stand up and do the job. Jeff, to your snarky texter, I hate to tell him, but $75,000 a year is really not all that much nowadays. I'm a union steam fitter, and anybody in the trades can make $75,000 a year, and I will guarantee we have better insurance than the police officers do. What's more important is, you know, and this is true for most of us, you go to work, like I say, you have good days, you have bad days. Maybe your boss praises you, maybe your boss yells at you, but... You know, a bad day for a police officer is you pull over or you stop when you find somebody who's in the ditch, you think they're drunk, and they pull out a gun and they shoot you. I mean, that's it. Jeff, this is a real concern for society. With crime at an all-time high and the perils that today's law enforcement face, we are headed into a dangerous situation. We can barely fill jobs in offices at restaurants. Who thinks people will willingly go into an extremely dangerous profession such as police work? Jeff, small town, big city, no way, not worth the stress. I deal with people every day, and I know how I get treated. Got to be 100 times worse if you're looking at law enforcement. Jeff, you should look at the community, at the commentary on the Reddit sub about the procession for the St. Croix officer. Saddening. This is how the young liberal generation thinks. No, I just... One of my policies is I try not to read comments that are on social media because I find that you can feel yourself losing IQ. And I have no doubt that there's people out there that, you know, want to say all sorts of uncharitable things. And yet a lot of those people would probably be the first ones wondering, where are the police when something bad happens to them? Okay, Wyatt, just check my emails. You know, and we're constantly told here to be very careful about, you know, clicking on different emails and things like that because we don't want to, you know, infect the whole community and things like that, you know? So yeah. I get an email. It says, computer login, Michael Diaz from help desk at Good Karma Brands. Good day. It's to me. This is Michael from Good Karma Broadcasting, LLC help desk.
Well, we're not called Good Karma Broadcasting anymore.
Right.
That's the first red
right.
flag.
And we don't have a help desk, as far as I know, at least. But I'm setting up your new computer. I, by the way, don't have a new computer. However, I need your login information in order to finish setting this up. Can I have your login information? Huh. Let's see. There's a, this is one when we go through like all these training sessions. It would be, how do you respond to this particular one? Do you hit reply and say, absolutely, here's my password?
Yeah, that's a little bit more blatant than I feel like it usually is. It's almost, it's a lot more tricky now sometimes with the way people try to get your information. They'll ask for a code or something. But
so what you're saying is this is an easy one.
Yeah,
this is an easy one.
They send us sometimes some fake ones to see if we're on the top of our game. I think this one's a real one, and this person's just not very good at scamming.
Okay, well, one way or the other, real one or fake one to see if I've caught on to this. Michael Diaz from Help Desk, you're not getting my information. This is one. Now, okay, this I got to be careful. Normally, I just delete these, but sometimes we're supposed to like pass this on to administrators, right?
Got to report it for phishing with a PH, like the band.
Okay, I got to figure out how to do that. How do I click on that? I'll figure out how to do that.
I can show you that in the break.
Okay, you can show me that because I don't. Right. The last thing I want to do is. Okay, so let me see more actions. Oh, I got it. More actions. And then fish alert, that is what I would hit? Okay, more action. All right, got it. Okay, so you agree this is not one that we want to click on.
Yeah, that's a little suspicious.
Okay, got it. See, I'm an old dog, but I can learn new tricks. Hey, when we come back, all right, you're a sanctuary city. What did you think was going to happen? Stick around. It has been 3.5 months since four, I believe it was men, robbed an armored car. You remember 8:15, January 26th, so 3.5 months ago, four guys stuck up an armored car, 79th and Capitol, and ended up getting away with well over $100,000. The armored truck was parked at North Shore Bank, and then what happened is they robbed it and got away with it. I have always made the point that, you should not rob anything, but trying to rob banks for a variety of reasons and trying to rob armored cars is particularly stupid because it's a federal offense, so you've immediately got not only local authorities, but also you've got the federal government looking for you. Armored cars and banks are typically, a lot of times there's armed guards in there, there's cameras and there's all sorts of stuff. But the four guys that knocked over the armored car in January, they have, at least up to this point, not been apprehended, which is, it's amazing. And I've told these stories. I mean, they're going to get caught at some point in time because people know who they are. My guess is the FBI knows who they are as well, and it's looking at them. And pretty soon they're going to spend this money, and then they're going to need to rob something else. And that's when they're typically going to be caught. But here's another reason not to rob armored cars. There was, let's see, Friday, 5 o'clock p.m., there was another attempt to rob an armored car outside of another North Shore bank. This happened just before 5 p.m. on Friday. Investigators say that a 47-year-old Kenosha man shot a 36-year-old armored car driver as he attempted to rob the armored truck. A separate guard then fired at the robbery suspect, who was struck and died from injuries at the scene. The 36-year-old guard initially shot was taken to the hospital. Thankfully, he is expected to survive. So this is the second time in the last 3.5 months that people have tried to rob an armored car outside of a North Shore bank. In this case, you know, what's happened is the would-be robber tries to rob the armored car, shoots one of the guards. The other guard returns fire and kills him. Two handguns and one shotgun were recorded at the scene. Case is going to the district attorney's office for charges. But the bottom line here is that it's another reason not to try to rob armored cars, because you know what? You could very well end up dead. And that's precisely what happened in this particular situation. I don't know if they're not saying whether there's any connection between these two robberies, but for the fact that it was an armored car, you know, at a North Shore bank. So I don't know that there's any link to the people that tried to rob the armored car on Friday versus the people, you know, 3.5 months ago. They haven't said anything like that yet. But the bottom line of all this is, just don't rob things, and in particular, don't rob banks, don't rob armored cars. Bad things will happen. All right, speaking of bad things happening. This week, the COVID era restrictions on crossing the border are about to expire. Now, I'm going to try to simplify this for the sake of our discussion. Right now, under the law, if you come into this country illegally and you say, I'm seeking asylum, the way the law works is you have to be conditionally admitted into the country while your asylum request is processed. Well, the problem is you've got thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are streaming illegally into this country on an almost weekly basis, if not daily basis. And they all say, I want asylum. And the problem is there's not enough immigration courts. There's not enough immigration judges. They can't. It's not like you can give these people who want asylum a hearing in 2 or 3 days. The hearings are months and months away, if then. So we don't have a spot to detain people. The vast majority of people who come into this country illegally seeking asylum do not qualify for asylum. They're not going to be granted asylum. But the fact that they request asylum essentially stops them from being able to be deported under the law. So what happens is they're given a date. Okay, this is your date for your asylum hearing. It's now May of 2023, January of 2024. Okay, well, so then they're just essentially released into the country and they disappear. And they, I mean, I'm not saying everybody, but a lot of people just never come back. You just ask for asylum and that's kind of like a get into this country free card. And then they just, again, disappear. We can never track them down. Now, as part of Trump-era COVID proceedings, we put in an emergency stopgap to that that essentially said, if you're coming in and you're claiming asylum, what we're going to do is we're going to immediately send you back across the border. And the argument was, hey, we've got fears that people who are coming into this country might be spreading COVID, et cetera, so we're going to send them back. That is about to expire this week. And the end of, I'm looking at one of the stories right now, Title 42 pandemic expulsions, they estimate right now that there are 10 to 12,000 migrants in Juarez right now waiting until Title 42 expires later this week to immediately pour into this country demanding asylum and then, again, being given, they can't be processed. They're going to be given dates and they're just going to kind of disappear into the country. The estimates are that's, okay, so this is what's going to happen. You have 10 to 12,000 immediately coming in and there will be thousands of more a week. Even the Biden administration understands that it's going to be a huge, huge crisis. And it's a particular crisis for these communities along the border, El Paso, Brownsville, whatever, who don't have the resources to deal with thousands and thousands and thousands of people suddenly streaming into their community. Imagine Kenosha, Wisconsin. And imagine if instead on the Illinois border, Kenosha, Wisconsin was Kenosha, Texas, and Kenosha was on the border. And suddenly you have 10 to 12,000 people immediately streaming in and saying, okay, we want asylum, and we want, now you've got to take care of us. We want to be fed. We want to be housed. We want to have some sort of health care. It would overwhelm local governments. And it is, in fact, overwhelming these governments. So what's happened is a number of these communities, with the blessing of the governor of Texas, have started taking not all, but some of the people who've come in illegally and are going to stay here, and they've started shipping them to various sanctuary cities. You know, these are the places like Chicago, who, when Donald Trump was the president, thought, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to declare ourselves to be a sanctuary city, and we're not going to cooperate with ICE, immigration, that is. We're going to say we're not going to We're going to extend all sorts of benefits to anybody who wants to come into this country illegally, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, for example, what Chicago did. Well, what they're doing now in Texas is they're saying, okay, this is what you wanted. Fine, you're a sanctuary city. So here, we're going to take some, certainly not all, but we're going to take some of the people that are coming in illegally, and we're going to send them up to Chicago. New York City, you declared yourself to be a sanctuary city. Fine, we're going to send, I don't know, number of people that are coming in illegally. We're going to bus some of them up to you and let you end up dealing with them. And now you've got the mayor of New York, you've got the outgoing mayor of Chicago and the incoming mayor of Chicago who are going, no, we can't deal with this. Texas, don't send us these people. El Paso, don't send us these people. Brownsville, don't send us a portion. It's a national problem. It's your local problem. But even though we're sanctuary cities, we don't want any responsibility for dealing with this. Okay, our number, 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. It was real interesting because I remember this conversation. We're going to be sanctuary cities. We're not going to deport people. We're going to extend benefits. We're not going to prosecute people. Okay, well, if you're a sanctuary city, all right, shouldn't you then be expected to do your share in dealing with the people who are pouring into this country? Nobody is saying that El Paso sends everybody up there, but Chicago, you said you wanted people who were coming in illegally. You wanted, you wanted to be able to extend these humanitarian benefits. Well, maybe you should be careful what you wish for. You fault the governor of Texas for shifting portions of the problems to some of these cities up north who said, hey, we're better than you. We're sanctuary cities. How dare you discriminate against people who are coming in the country illegally? Seems to me this might be a question and an issue of be careful what you wish for. 855-616-1620. It's going to get worse before it gets better. And should the governor of Texas, for example, stop spreading the problem around, or should this exclusively be a problem confined to border cities around in Texas or in Arizona? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. There was a point in time where it was fashionable to be a sanctuary city. The mayor of Chicago, the outgoing mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, we're a sanctuary city. We want people to come in. We're not going to cooperate with immigration. We're not going to report them. We're going to extend all these benefits. Okay, fine. New York the same way. So it's easy to say that when you don't have any sort of skin in the game. Well, now that, and it's May 11th, that these restrictions on immigration and requests for asylum, that expires. And as bad as it has been, it's going to get exponentially worse. And so now you've got New York, you've got Chicago. They're saying, oh, don't send us these people. You deal with it. You deal with the problem in Texas. So in essence, they're now reap what would be the phrase. You are reaping what you've sowed. All right. You were a sanctuary city, but now the governor of Texas is about ready to start resuming busing people who come into this country illegally, request asylum, and cannot be removed in the immediate near future. He's sending them up to Chicago. He's sending them up to New York. All right. 855-616-1620. I just think you're reaping what you've sown. Mike in Illinois. Mike, your neck of the woods. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon, Jeff. How are you?
Good. What do you think?
Yeah, I've listened to Lori Lightfoot bitch about it now for, a little while. These towns, these border towns in Arizona, Texas, they've been dealing with this for decades.
Right.
And Chicago and New York get a little taste of it, and they're crying like children. They said we're sanctuary cities. Well, let them put their money where their mouth is.
Yeah, Mike, that's exactly, that's exactly it. Now, Chicago, I think since this process started, that the numbers I saw is there's like 8,000. Okay, which is a lot, but it's a fraction. I mean, that's the number of people that are pouring, across the border into some of these communities on a weekly basis. And this idea that, okay, it's your problem, Texas. Well, all right. I mean, this is actually, it's what happens when you have some of these progressives out there who have this holier-than-thou sort of attitude on immigration. Well, okay, now you have to confront the consequences of some of your behavior. And it's one thing if, okay, we're not going to cooperate with immigration when we've got, you know, a couple hundred people, but now we've got thousands. Well, oh, okay, maybe what you need to do is you need to pick up the phone and you need to call President Biden. You need to say, hey, we need to get better control of the border, as opposed to simply saying, all right, immigration is a local problem. The influx of people coming into the country illegally and requesting asylum, that's a problem that faces the country, but it's also a problem that faces Brownsville or El Paso, Texas. Well, no, it's a problem that confronts the entire country. And if you're going to be mouthy and lip off about, okay, we're better than you and we want this, all right, well, you got to deal with, I think, some of the consequences of your decisions. Charlie in Germantown. Charlie, you're on WTMJ.
Jeff, good afternoon.
Hi, Charlie.
I think that the White House has a whole lot of spare bedrooms, so why don't we ship a bunch of these immigrants up to the White House and let Joe tuck them in at night? I mean, I'm talking stupid, but that's just how stupid this whole program is.
Well,
thank you for your time.
Thanks, Charlie. Well, or Delaware. I don't think Joe spends his weekends in Delaware. I mean, let's send places to Delaware. You know, all these places that want to be sanctuary cities. Look, I understand this is a problem, and I'm not trying to be flip about it, but it's really, really easy for a lot of these large urban areas to have this holier-than-thou sort of attitude and approach to this. We need to have, you know, we need to be tolerant of these people who are coming across the country, into our country, looking for a better life. Okay, but we don't want to have to deal with this problem. You deal with it, Texas. You deal with it, Arizona. Don't expect us to be part of the problem. Well, nuts to that. I mean, it is a national problem, and it seems to me it's something everybody should be sharing. And candidly, if more communities had skin in the game, I think there'd be less of this sanctuary city stuff and this self-righteousness, and that's what you're seeing happen. Now New York and Chicago are suffering the consequences of some of their decision-making, and it's tough for me to be too sympathetic.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the show. Wyatt, you want to take a guess before you leave and go back to the newsroom? Here is my question. What would you guess? I've got the numbers from March. What would you guess is the average price of a new car in the United States in March? If you had to take a guess. Average price.
$22,000.
Wyatt says $22,000. Producer Charlie, let you play in this. Would you like to take a guess? March of 2023, the average price of a new car in the United States?
I would say $32,000.
$22,000. You guys are not only are you both wrong, neither one of you, with all due respect, is even close. Here's the numbers. The average price of a new car in the United States in March, $48,008. Now that's average. So, I mean, half are more expensive, half are less expensive. $48,000. You're looking at me blankly.
That's a lot of money.
Well, yeah, that's the point of where we're going. And that's up, by the way, that's up 30% from March of 2020. So, kind of doing the math, that would have been, you know, if I was asking you that question 3 years ago, you know, 13 grand, you know, Charlie, you would kind of be in the ballpark, you know, but it's up 30% over the last 3 years. On top of that, it's interest rates have gone up dramatically. You know, it used to be, you know, if you financed a car or tried to finance a car in March of 2020, you could probably get an interest rate even back then of, you know, 1%, 2%, something like that. Now, you know, you're talking about interest rates of 5-6%, maybe even more, depending on what you're going to buy. I was talking to a friend of mine over the weekend who sells cars for a living, and they were saying, you know, for the cost of cars together with the interest rates that are being charged are just pricing people out of this. And there's a story, what got me thinking about this is there's a story in the Washington Post. The headline is New Cars, Once Part of the American Dream, Now Are Out of Reach for Many.
Higher interest rates have hit as automakers double down on pricier models. More about that in just a second. The average price for a new car hit $48,008 in March. Juan David Ramirez knows that his 2012 Nissan Juke SL is on its last legs, but buying a new car in the Orlando area these days reminds him of car buying in his home country of Colombia, where only the wealthy can afford new cars. Ramirez, 33, and his wife really want a new small SUV with a little space for camping and paddleboarding gear. But despite good jobs in finance and business contracting, the couple's monthly loan payment would run around $700 for the $35,000 models they're looking at before dealer markups. So they plan to patch up the Nissan, which is paid off. He blames the manufacturers and dealers for charging so much for cars. Well, I mean, it's a lot of things that are going on. It's the rise in interest rates, which, you know, beyond the control of the dealers. But, you know, the financing, you can't get 1% and 2% financing anymore. You know, you're talking 5%, 6% financing, whatever that would be, which, just like if you go to buy a home, dramatically increases the costs of buying cars. And some people might say, gee, buying one of these high-end cars costs more than I paid for my home decades ago. So you've got that. In addition, what's happened is because of the shortages during the pandemic and the problems with getting parts and chips and things like that, a lot of the automakers have concentrated on trying to increase their profit margins. So they've been making more of the pricier cars where there's more of a profit margin built in. So like if you make the $60,000 car with all these bells and whistles that have a higher markup than making the $30,000 car with fewer bells and whistles. So there's a limited amount of chips or parts or whatever. So they're making the pricier models where they can make more money. So you've got interest rates. You've got those shortages that are going on. But the bottom line is, you know, the average car in March, $48,000. Now, it always used to be that. And of course, one of the other things that is going on, and I know some people don't want to hear about this, but because of the government's push towards EVs, a number of these automakers are taking B as in billions of dollars and using it to try to, in anticipation of producing more electric vehicles, you know, a few years from now, they're switching more and more and they're putting more and more dollars into like research on these electric vehicles, which means, you know, the part of gas vehicles, you know, the prices on those have to go up to cover for the quote unquote money that they're investing in the electric vehicles. Interestingly, to that point, USA Today says that March of this year, 20% of new vehicle shoppers said that they were very unlikely to consider an electric vehicle, up from 18% in February and 17% in January. More and more people are just saying we're not even interested in electric vehicles. But it's all these things. More money being put into the investigation or switching production lines for electronic vehicles, higher interest rates, shortages. But $48,000 on average. Now, again, that means that's the average. So it means, but like, think about it. It means for every, you know, $28,000 car they're selling a $68,000 car as well. 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Have you been in the market for a new car recently? And have you been amazed by the sticker shock? And I'm wondering what people, particularly what average people do when it comes to, you know, looking and figuring out, okay, my car's on the last legs, and I mean, I need a car to get back and work back and forth to work. I need a car to get the kids to, you know, school and to the soccer games and all those things. And my 10-year-old car is kind of on its last legs. Are the price of new cars essentially becoming unaffordable for a huge chunk of Americans? And what do we do with that? Is it, okay, we're going to invest in trying to, you know, keep the cars running, used cars, but the prices of used cars are through the roof as well. All right, have we gotten to the point where for at least average people, it's becoming difficult, if not impossible, to buy new cars? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620. A lot of people watching our show today. And I say watching, yeah, because it's a radio show. We always have lots of people listening, but you can also watch it. We live stream. We've got cameras here. Studios lit up like a Christmas tree. And it's really easy to do that. We've got our own YouTube channel. And also, you just go to WTMJ.com. You see a little button that says Watch Live if you want to do that as well. All right, I was actually kind of surprised about this. The average cost, and I think probably a lot of people are, the average cost of a new car in March in the United States, average, $48,008. $48,000. And on top of that, you've got, it's not like the days of 0% financing or, you know, 1% financing in general. You're talking about 5, 6% interest. So in some cases, matter of fact, we have one of our texters says that, you know, that looking at the price of a new car, the monthly payment on the new car would be, with the interest rate, more than the monthly payment on their mortgage. Jeff, I just bought a 23 Nissan truck, $63,000, discounted $5,000 in good interest rates. I'm okay with that, I guess. You've got that there. Jeff, just picking up a new car tomorrow, don't want electric, so decided to bite the bullet before cars got even more expensive. Our Subaru Outback comes in just under the average cost of new cars today. Jeff, as somebody who's purchased about 10 new vehicles, I just can't see spending that much for a car, and it really doesn't do, you know, anything for me. Jeff, we just purchased a new car last month. Our intent was to order a new car, but it was a 6-month wait and the price was about $10,000 more than we expected. Therefore, we bought a 2-year-old vehicle for the price we intended to pay for the new vehicle. Yeah, I mean, I wonder how many people are going for, you know, the partially owned vehicles. They say, go in and say, okay, my budget is, you know, $32,000, and I think I should be able to get a new car for that. And then you go and you find, oh, you want that new car, it's going to cost you $42,000, so you go for the used car. Is that what people are doing? 855-616-1620. Let's start with Jim in Kenosha. Jim, you're on WTMJ.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I've got a 2019 Buick Encore that I've leased. And my lease buyout on the car was just under $15,000, and it's selling for $24,000 on a used car lot.
Right.
And I got about 20,000 miles on the car. I don't drive a whole lot.
Right.
So I just bought the car at the end of the lease because I was looking at getting into a new car. I looked at, you know, Hyundai and Buick, and a bunch of availability was down.
Right.
And any of the Hyundais I wanted, there was a waiting list, so I just paid cash for the car at the end of my lease, and I don't have a car payment anymore.
Yeah, that sounds like the math on your lease, it sounds to me like it's a kind of a no-brainer. That is, I mean, especially since your car has relatively low mileage, and you figure, you know, you're going to get a lot more years out of it. But isn't it amazing sticker shock to go and look at new cars nowadays?
I used to sell cars back in the early 90s when they'd give a loan to anyone that could breathe.
Right.
And, sticker shock is, you know, you want how much for what?
Yeah.
And
Right. No, thanks. Well, not only that, but the inventory. I mean, I was telling the story the other day. I was if you go to a car lot and you try to buy one off the lot. Now, I mean, I grew up in the era where you go to the car lots and there's, I don't know, you've got 40, 50, 60 different cars that are on the lot. Maybe some of the big dealers, they got hundreds of cars on the lot, and you know, you have no choice. You got lots of choices. Hey, I want a white car. I want it with this feature and that feature. No problem. We'll pull it up. Nowadays, you know, good luck. I was telling the story the other day. I went to a car lot and they said there were like 7 or 8 of this particular model car on the lot. I get there and they say, well, no, we only have 2, and both of them are in colors not found in nature. And well, I said, well, but the internet, your website says you've got all these other ones. Well, no, those are in transit. Okay, well, what does that mean? Well, it means that they're going to come here. They're coming here. Well, when are they going to get here? Well, maybe a day or two, maybe from a while ago. And so now thankfully it wasn't a problem. Telling the story because if you're a regular listener, you know, I had ordered a new car and I actually picked it up over the weekend. Love it. But it's really kind of sticker shock when you sit there and you say, okay, if, you know, for all of us who grew up, okay, this is, You know, every 3 years you change your car, you get yourself a new car or whatever. These prices just going absolutely through the roof. And especially, I mean, I wonder what happens for those of you who have, I don't know, kids that are driving. You're thinking about, okay, maybe, you know, maybe I want to pick up a new car and give my car to the kids or whatever. I mean, what do you do with this? Average price, $48,000 plus the interest rate they're charging. Let's talk to Kristen in Saukville. Kristen, you're on WTMJ.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. So I have a 2012 Toyota Highlander. It has almost 238,000 miles on it. And last summer, we were faced with the decision. There were some things going wrong with it. It was going to be a few $1,000s to fix it. And so we're trying to think, you know, should we buy a new car? Should we just fix the one that we have for a few thousand? And we went to look, or we kind of looked at the prices of new Highlanders. And we're like, no, we're just going to throw a few thousand into it. And hopefully it lasts another year or two until this is over. Well, I'm not sure this is going to be over anytime soon.
No, I you know, that's the thing, because I don't think interest rates are going to drop dramatically. And especially also, and I'm not making a political comment here, but with all the pressure these automakers are having to convert to like electric and things like that, that's money that's diverted. I think they got to make that money back by keeping prices high. And they're just simply producing more of the higher end cars than the lower end cars. Because like I was saying, that's where the profit margin is. You know, you can make more money, you know, higher profit margin selling a $60,000 car than you can selling a $25,000 car. So as long as there's a market, that's where they're going.
Yeah, it's just hard to stomach, but we've made that decision.
Yeah, well, good luck. I hope the car lasts for another 3 years. That would be nice, huh?
Yeah, thank you.
No, thanks for calling. No, I mean, and I appreciate you wrestle with this. Pete in Sarasota, Florida. Pete, good afternoon.
Hey, Jeff, how are you today?
I am well, thank you. Okay, you've been looking for a car?
Yeah, we were looking for a car. Usually I keep my cars for about 15 plus years, get a couple hundred thousand on them, but I was forced, unfortunately, my car had 150, had some engine issues, and trying to fix it, it just wasn't worth it.
Right.
So I was looking at a new Bronco, and I went to a dealership, and he gave me a price, and I said, I only wanted one. And he said, no, they...
No, I'm not looking for a package deal, just one. Yeah, okay.
And they jacked up the list price so high, I just couldn't do that. And they were trying to get me to buy this, but I ended up getting a BMW at sticker price, at least.
Right.
So I'm satisfied with that. So hopefully this thing will last me a while.
Yeah, well, and also, of course, you know, after the hurricane in Florida, prices of cars, just with so many that were just scrapped, prices just went absolutely through the roof, too.
Oh, and that's it. I was looking at a 2 to 3 year old car that had 30,000 almost out of warranty, and they were still asking almost new price.
Yeah, no, and thanks. And I guess the point of this, there's no bad guys here, but it's really different. I mean, and this is kind of the point of the Washington Post story. Well, because for the longest time, you know, the idea has been that people, many people, not everybody, but many people could afford new cars. And I mean, look, not everybody could go and buy, you know, a Mercedes and things like that, or a BMW or an Audi. But there was a whole range of cars, and you could go and you could buy a new car with the warranties, and it was affordable for all sorts of different people. That's changed by virtue of all the different things that we've talked about and the interest rate increases and stuff. But the idea of people who don't have a lot of money to put down, or, you know, might be in a more precarious financial position or whatever, the idea, if you think you're going to be able to go in and get a car for, you know, $18,000 or whatever, it's just maybe they're there, but they're not a lot of them. Jeff, I had to get a new used 2016 car last July. The 2016 cost me $15,000. The previous car I had was 2010, and it cost $7,000 used. I can barely afford a new used car now. Jeff, it's cheaper to fix what you have, you know. You know, maybe. Jeff, I have a new driver. I will have a new driver next October, and we have started looking into a new car for my husband or a used car for my son. Oh, to both options. Well, yeah. Jeff, I'm going to keep driving my 2013 Toyota Highlander. Great vehicle, and new is way, way, way too expensive. Jeff, I found a non-rusty Yukon XL 2016 for $28,000. It has 92,000 miles on it. I couldn't pass it up. 92,000 miles. $28,000. One of the texters has just kind of made my day in a sort of bad way. I hadn't even thought of it. Okay, so like I said, I got a new car, finally got it delivered. And over the weekend, I sent an email to my insurance agent saying, okay, I've just taken possession of this new car. This is what the car is. This is what the purchase price was. And, you know, please add it to the insurance policy. And they sent me a note this morning saying, okay, it's on. And, you know, you'll be getting a bill. And I hadn't thought of that. One of our texters says, Jeff, the increase in car prices is increasing the cost of new car insurance since it costs more to replace. Yep, that's probably I haven't looked at what the it's going to be, but I'm sure that will be another. That'll just be another one of these wonderful surprises, which is one of the reasons I'll probably have to work till I'm 90. Right, Wyatt?
Definitely.
All right, there you go. Yeah, we've been telling you all day, the Brewers earlier this year announced that for games at American Family Field, typically they would cut off beer sales at the end of the seventh inning. Now this year, and I think it's a great move, the pitch clock, they have the pitch clock in, and games are moving a lot faster. So what they said is that they were going to extend beer sales through the eighth inning. And it created, I don't know if it was controversy, but there were people saying, oh, this is going to lead to more drunk driving and things like that, to which I was kind of like, well, I think that was kind of an overreaction. And I've been to, I mean, I'm a season ticket holder. I got partial season tickets. So, I've been to three or four games already this year. And I will just tell you, from at least in our area, I saw almost nobody buying beer in the eighth inning, simply because, I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons. Maybe it's concern about drinking and driving, but I think it's also a lot of people, even with the faster game, start to leave around that time. In addition, let's face it, I mean, buying beers at the stadium is an expensive proposition. And I think, you know, that very, you know, last call sort of thing, I think, you know, especially as quickly as games move along, I think there's some people say, hey, if I'm in the middle of the eighth inning, I buy a beer, game might be over before I have a chance to drink it. So I didn't think that there was, it didn't seem to me, at least anecdotally, that there was a lot of beer being sold after the seventh inning. And so I think that's what they're saying. The Brewers have announced today that they're going back to where it was before. It's back to the future, and the seventh inning is going to be the last call, you know, once again. Then I think the answer is that it's not, what they're saying is it's not related to problems or anything like that. It's just that concessions, you know, drops off in the later innings. And the fact that, you know, by keeping the beer vendors working in the stands or whatever for another 15 minutes or something, it's really, I think they've kind of concluded it's not worth it. There's just not enough sales to justify having the people do it. So I don't think that is not necessarily a surprise for me. Again, it just, I don't think, if people are saying, oh, this is because there was drunk driving and stuff. No, I just think it's kind of a business decision. You know, a lot of times, you know, why, you know, maybe bars or restaurants that used to be open till, you know, 10 o'clock now close at 9 o'clock because they're finding that there's just not enough late night business to justify them staying open. So, you know, why do we have people, why do we keep people here on salary or something when there's just not that much interest? And I think that's more of it. They just weren't selling enough to, you know, justify the decision to do it. Hey, if you follow me on Twitter, I just sent out a new tweet because sometimes there are these stories where a picture is worth 1,000 words. And nowadays, we see reckless driving stories all over. And you go, man, look at where that car ended up. Or wow, boy, I'm glad I wasn't around that. There's something that happened. Let me see. It happened, you know, earlier today. And it happened out at the old Columbia St. It's a Columbia St. Mary's Hospital. Now it's the Ascension Hospital in Mequon. And this is like on Port Washington. You can picture it's Port Washington Road and Highland. And it's, you know, it's a relatively, I mean, it's a relatively big hospital. And if you live, you know, in Ozaukee County or in that area, you're probably familiar with this. There, I've got a link, and you can follow me on Twitter. It's at JeffWagner620. I've got a link to the Fox 6 story on this. A car Car crashes into Mequon Hospital entrance. A car has crashed into the Seton Professional Building, which is, you know, part of the hospital complex. And you know, normally you think of a car crash, and the car would, I don't know, drive, you know, parallel into the front of the building. You know, the building has, like, these sliding doors in the front, and normally you would think that the car would, like, crash through it with the front of the car, or sometimes if the car's backing up, the rear of the car going through it. The car is parked sideways. It has crashed through the doors, and it is sitting in the entranceway sideways. I have no idea how a car gets through this and ends up sideways. I mean, that's what I sent out the tweet. It's like I'm curious as to how this car ended up where it ended up. Because you look at it and you go, okay, I understand if the car would have, again, gone through, the door is, if you can think of it horizontally, and the car went through vertically or whatever. But this, the car is inside, the doors are smashed, and the car is inside, again, sideways. How do you get the car sideways? Do you crash through and then try to back up? And I just have no idea, and I'd be just really curious to try to figure out, how did that car get where it ended up? You know, you just kind of think, I'm always wondering about that. So there you have it. All right. Wyatt was bringing you this story as well. And it's we're going to see more of this stuff happening around schools as we get closer to schools letting out for the summer. You have more complaints of more hoax bomb threats or things like that, because you have some, you know, kid who wants to get off for the day or whatever, and so, hey, it's senior skip out day, so I'm going to call in a bomb threat. So historically, May and early June, you see an uptick on that. What we're also seeing an uptick on, though, are these swatting threats. And we've talked about this on the program before. Swatting, and it kind of goes back to the old TV show, you know, SWAT, where you have the reactive team that goes out. And this has been happening a lot all over, where you have a situation where there's a call, for example, that's made and says, I'm at such and such school. I've just killed four people, and I'm going to kill more. All right, and that call comes into the police department, and then the police department has no choice but to react. They drop everything they're doing, and you have the county sheriff's department, the local police department, and maybe the FBI, and everybody responds to the school, and they go on lockdown, and they freak out all the parents because they send out these email alerts, and it turns out to be just a fake. You know, it happens sometimes with regard to people who get targeted by this. I'm at such and such an address. I've just killed, you know, everybody inside the building. I've got a high-powered gun. I'm going to kill anybody that tries to take me out. And so then, again, the police have to respond. They evacuate all the neighbors, and it turns out to be just, again, a hoax. Sometimes it's driven by computer-generated calls from overseas. Sometimes it's generated by somebody halfway across the country who has a beef with the person. But this is how, you know, law enforcement, and I get it, they respond to this way, because even if you think that this is a hoax and you think it's a fake or whatever, what if you're wrong? What if the guy really is in that school with the high-powered rifle and has done this? Can you imagine what happens if you don't treat it like it's what it purported could be? Well, we've had another example of that. There's a Meijer grocery store that actually is a couple miles up the road on Port Washington Road from the Columbia St. Mary's Ascension Hospital I was just talking about, that somehow has this car sideways in the front entrance. You look at this picture and you go, how did that car get there? Well, anyhow, there was a swatting call made to the Meijer. Apparently, somebody called in a bomb threat at the Meijer grocery store. As a precaution, the building was evacuated. The parking lot was closed. No traffic was allowed into the parking lot. And this turns out to be, again, a completely bogus situation. Officials say other Meijer stores in other jurisdictions, and Myers, of course, a national company, they received similar calls. So today was Myers' turn in the box, I guess, where you had somebody that, or some group of people or whatever, that decided that this is the day that we're going to close down this business and freak out all the neighbors and, you know, create all this chaos. And, you know, the police are between a rock and a hard place because, as a practical matter, it's almost impossible to figure out who's doing this. And then, like I say, many times the folks who are doing this are overseas, and so you can't prosecute them anyways. But, you know, here this Meijer store, I mean, I don't know how long it was closed down, but you know the employees were traumatized. You know patrons were traumatized. It was a huge inconvenience. Our number is 855-616-1620. We've only got a couple minutes. I'm honestly looking for ideas. As this swatting stuff becomes more and more prevalent, how should we handle this? I mean, because our reaction right now is to treat every one of these swatting calls, whether it's a school or a personal residence or a business, to treat it like it is the real thing. That's how we do it. But, of course, I mean, maybe thankfully, in almost all cases, it doesn't turn out to be the real thing. But it creates an incredible inconvenience. Now, obviously, the people who are doing it, to the extent you can catch them, you want them prosecuted. But that's very, very difficult. My question is, the justification would be better safe than sorry. Do we continue to allow ourselves to be held hostage to these swatting calls? Or do we need to come up with a better way of doing at least some preliminary screening to determine if there's some validity to it? 855-616-1620. I don't have a good answer. Do you? We discuss in a moment. Jeff, there is a fella I know who has been swatted over 10 times, lives on the east side. He obviously has an enemy. Well, yeah. And I guess you would think that, and I'm not criticizing law enforcement for the response here, but, you know, you get the call from the school, oh, I've got the gun, I've just shot three or four people, or, you know, so-and-so is in this particular location. Hi, I'm so-and-so, I've just, you know, killed my wife, killed my kids, I've got a gun, I'm ready to go. I mean, and the response is you evacuate the neighbors, you know, you go there and it turns out to be completely bogus. You know, obviously, in some cases, you know, it's perhaps easier. A lot of times, these organized things, and if you're just tuning in, that the Meijer grocery store in Grafton got swatted this morning. Oh, there's a bomb in the store. And so, I mean, authorities, they close down the store, they close down the parking lot, they evacuate everybody. I mean, I don't know if the store shut down for an hour or 2 hours. It loses all this business. It creates all this consternation. And it's part of a nation. Apparently, there were Meijer stores in all sorts of other jurisdictions that had the same thing happen. One of our listeners, Kelly, texts in and says, look, Jeff, how can they not figure out who's doing this with the technology that we have these days? Well, I understand it, and I get that, but part of it is, especially with like the internet and stuff, I mean, remember all the swatting calls that came out like last spring against the schools, and it was this computerized voice that did that and those things, and it turned out to be somebody overseas, and you know, if this is happening out of, you know, Russia or Lithuania or whatever, you know, your chances of identifying who's doing it are probably slim to none, and your chances of prosecuting are slim to none. I would love to see law enforcement get together and really put their heads together, though, and try to figure out some way of verifying, or at least some preliminary thing, to try to figure out, okay, some stopgap, instead of simply saying, we're going to drop everything and rush out. And I understand that's tough, because, you know, even if 99 out of 100 are going to be bogus, you want to have a quick response to the one that isn't bogus. But as more and more of the swatting stuff goes on, I just think we've got to figure out a way to at least do some preliminary screening to weed out the completely bogus ones. Otherwise, we allow the swatters to hold ourselves hostage.